ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For more than four decades, David Lindenmayer has spent much of his time in the wet eucalypt forests of Victoria's Central Highlands. It's a place he loves, the towering mountain ash and alpine ash trees rising up through the mist, the dense understory of ferns and fallen logs covered in moss and lichen, the sharp, pure calls of whipbirds and lyrebirds. These tall, wet forests are home to a little possum, Leadbeater's possum, also known as the fairy possum, which weighs less than an apple and which for many years was believed to be extinct. It was Leadbeater possums who first drew David into the forest. As a 23-year-old, it was his job to capture and count them. David is now a distinguished professor of forest ecology at the Australian National University. He leads some of the largest long-term research programs in the country and is a prolific author of scientific articles and books. His latest is called The Forest Wars. Hi, David.
Hello, Sarah.
Let's start with the possum that you went into the Victorian forest to study. What does a Leadbeater's possum look like up close?
Gosh, a Leadbeater's possum, the body is about the size of the palm of your hand, and then it has a long tail that's like a small baseball bat. So it's pinched at the base and then sort of club-like at the end. And the tail helps the animal balance as it's jumping through the forest because it moves like grease lightning as it shoots through the understory. So, yeah, quite a remarkable animal.
And what colour? What's its fur like?
They're steel grey, but they have a distinctive black stripe along the back. And most of the different possums and gliders that eat saps and gums actually have that black stripe, and it's thought to resemble the sap as it runs down the trunk of a tree.
They are ridiculously cute. They look like kind of a sweet little Japanese cartoon creature. Is that how they behave?
Absolutely not. They're absolutely the antithesis of that. And when people started calling them the fairy possum, I thought there could not be a less apt name for such an animal. It's they're really quite aggressive and feisty. They bite like crazy in a bag if you do catch them. And the thing about them is that they're colonial. So they live in groups of up to 12, and they have a dominant adult female that runs the colony. And if there's actually a threat, such as an owl or another predator, and one of the colony members elicits an alarm call, then all the others come running in through the forest, attracted to that alarm call, and then they work together and drive off the predator.
Really? What, through biting or just intimidation?
Oh, biting and mobbing the predator. And one of the things is that when you've seen this enough and you've heard it enough, it's the alarm call is actually pretty straightforward to mimic.
Can you give me a sense of it?
So you stand there in the forest and you go, and if it's an area of forest that you haven't been in for a while, then the possums are there, then they'll actually be attracted quite close. And in fact, so close that you can catch them by hand. And if you're not watching what you're doing and there's several possums, you can actually be bitten. And I feel like
you're speaking from personal experience, David. We've moved from the realm of abstract science into personal recollection here. How have you been savaged by a fairy possum?
I was calling up some animals to show people that there were Leadbeater's possum in the area. And I had one that I'd caught by hand, but I didn't see the other one that came and actually bit me between the eyes. And I have a small scar. It's not a Harry Potter scar, but it's I have a scar between my eyes. Yes.
Were you shocked, outraged? How did you respond?
Well, I was a bit shocked to start with, but then I thought it was pretty cool to be probably the biggest but also the ugliest owl that these possums had ever seen.
Well, how big an animal have you seen a colony of Leadbeater possums fight off?
I've seen them drive off a booble cow. That was really, really quite remarkable.
Because that's a much bigger animal.
That's a much bigger animal. Not in terms of body weight, but in terms of physical size. And that's something to behold.
And so you say they live in colonies of around 12 Leadbeater possums together run by a dominant female. Is that common in marsupials in Australia to have a matriarch?
It's not that common, although one of the things that's kind of interesting is that there's a lot of flexibility in the social organisation of these different species. So some animals are colonial, usually the small ones, and they often live together so that they can huddle together as a way of conserving energy, whereas the bigger animals tend to be in pairs or sometimes solitary.
And where do they sleep? Where do they make a home if there's that many little animals together?
So in a colony of 12, what happens is that animals will make a nest inside one of these giant mountain ash trees. So often there'll be a fissure or a crack in the tree, and the animals will make their way into the centre of the tree, and at various times they'll harvest bark streamers from the forest, and then shred it up, wrap it up in their tail, and then take it inside the tree, and then weave together this incredible nest that's about the size of a football.
What? And they all sleep in that together?
They sleep in that together. But the thing is that they don't live in just one tree. What we've discovered from radio tracking work, we put little collars on animals and follow them from day to day to day, is that they move regularly between different hollow trees. And that's probably a way of being able to make sure they monopolise the suitable trees in an area, but also to make sure that predators like owls don't learn their behaviours. They're in an arms race with owls.
Can you tell just looking at a tree if there's going to be a colony of leadbeater possums inside it?
In some cases, it's quite straightforward to see where particular kinds of trees have got particular features which make them very likely to be leadbeater's possum trees. And usually it's the very big dead trees, and there's some physics associated with how those big trees move in the wind. And that leads to the outer shell of that dead hollow tree cracking, and that provides the perfect entrance for these animals to be able to access the middle part. And often there's rotting material inside the tree, so it acts like a giant compost heap, which is brilliant to be able to put your nest on top of that.
What happens when one colony of leadbeater possums comes across another colony of leadbeater possums?
Well, there's a lot of territorial disputes along the boundary, and you'll hear them chattering and challenging to one another about, you know, don't come onto my patch and we won't go onto yours kind of thing. And it's something to really behold when you're out in the forest at night time and you can hear these animals challenging one another.
They're so little, David. What do they eat?
So leadbeater's possum eats saps and gums from acacias, and also it eats insects, including hunting for insects in these bark streamers that hang off the lateral branches of these giant trees. And one of the things that they love to eat are these aerial tree crickets that look ferocious. And I've seen them in a spotlight tackling these tree crickets. So it's quite an event way up in the trees.
What's the story of them being thought to be extinct and then discovered again?
So they were first discovered in the southern part of Gippsland in Victoria, in largely a swampy, shrubby area, very dense country. And there was only a handful of specimens that were collected from that part of the world in the 1860s. And then that swampy area was almost completely cleared and converted to pastures and other areas that were denuded of trees. So it was presumed that the animals were extinct. And so by the early 1900s, it was added to the list of extinct Australian mammals. And then it turned up again in 1961, but in a completely different area and a completely different habitat from where it had been previously described. And then it turned out that there were a number of places across an area of about 60 kilometres by 80 kilometres in size that had little colonies of leadbeater's possum throughout. So it was rediscovered in 1961. And it's really been a focus of a lot of research in those tall, wet Victorian forests ever since. It became Victoria's faunal emblem.
How did that happen, do you know? Was that a highly competitive choice? How did the leadbeater's possum win out?
Oh, well, I think it's an animal that, because it only occurs in Victoria, it was one of the species that was put up. The other one was the helmeted honeyeater, which is also a highly endangered, critically endangered species. So Victoria has two faunal emblems, and both are very, very at risk of going extinct.
These little possums also helped you meet your wife, David. What's the story there?
Gosh, in the early 1990s, we were radio tracking leadbeater's possum, and we were trying to work out how many different den trees in these giant mountain ash Leadbeater's possum colonies were using and how much they were swapping between sites. Now, when you put a radio collar on a possum, these animals are very feisty, but you have to make sure that you put the collar on precisely correctly. Otherwise, animals can get their foot underneath the collar and it can kill them. So what we did is we took them into the Healesville Sanctuary and we sedated animals so that we're able to fit the collar perfectly and then take them back out into the forest.
Are they tricky to trap before you get to that point?
Oh, they're very hard to trap. You need to have a very, very tall ladder. You need a lot of muscles to be able to carry one of these ladders through the forest. You have to carry it vertically, not horizontally, because the forest is so dense.
How do you feel about climbing up those very tall ladders?
I'm absolutely petrified. I'm scared of heights.
So you've got to climb up there, and with what, a bag? Put your hand into the nest. How do you get them?
So what happens is that you put the traps very close to where the animal's nest tree is, not on the nest tree itself, because we've discovered that they often don't like to be trapped in those areas, but close by where they're moving through the forest. And then the way that we put the traps up in the trees is we put a metal bracket that's nailed into the trunk of a smaller wattle tree usually. And then on top of that bracket goes a metal box that's got creamed honey and other baits inside. And then we put a plastic sleeve over the trap in case it rains. We don't want the animal to get wet. We want the animal to stay warm. And then we put what's called wood wool or wood shavings into the trap so the animal's got something to sit on. And then you plaster the wattles and the trap bracket with honey to attract the animal into the trap.
And so once you've got some and you were taking them into the Healesville Sanctuary to sedate them so you could put the collars on.
Yes.
And how did love appear at that most romantic of settings?
Well, love appeared because we needed the services of a vet to make sure that the anaesthetic was being administered right and just to check that the fitting of the collar was working. And across the room helping in this space was a vet. A beautiful young woman who was transfixed by the possum and was interested in talking to one of the possum catchers. And there must have been a lot of chemistry at that stage because I was actually going out with a woman from Denmark at that stage. And once we got back out into the forest to release the possums, I got into trouble for noticing the vet.
But you and the vet continue to be a happy story many years on, so...
That's correct. We've been together virtually ever since then.
So can you also sedate these little possums in the field, or do you always have to bring them back into a vet surgery?
Well, what happened many years later was that as a birthday present for my wife, I bought her a mobile gas anaesthetic machine.
Who wants flowers?
That's
when
right.
That's on offer. And that lets you, what, put the collars on out in the bush?
Yes, we can use that machine to sedate animals and make sure the collar's fitted right. And we've actually used it on many other occasions now, including some work on diamond pythons, where we've sedated a diamond python or a whole series of diamond pythons. Now, you can't put a collar on a python, but you can put a transmitter inside the body wall. And so you sedate the animal. It's important to have another person working with you because they've actually got to breathe for the snake. So you actually have to have a machine that helps continue to push oxygen into the snake while it's sedated and while you're putting the device inside the snake. So we've used that gas machine working on greater gliders, on squirrel gliders, tiger quolls, diamond pythons, Leadbeater's possum, yeah.
The first time you went into this forest, this tall, wet eucalypt forest of Victoria, what do you remember being most struck by? What was it like?
First of all, the sheer size of the trees is it's almost hard to describe. A tree that's, up to 15 metres in circumference. If you were to walk around a tree, it can be 15 metres and sometimes a lot more.
So what does that mean for how tall they are if they're that kind of girth?
So those trees, the biggest trees that we've measured are about 98 to 99 metres. Now, there are some in Tasmania that are over 100 metres tall, and there are trees that have been measured reputedly over 120 metres tall. So they're the world's tallest flowering plants. They're not as tall as the giant redwoods in California, but they're pretty close to it.
And how old are trees of that kind of size?
Trees of that size might be between 300 and 350 to 400 years old. And the thing that's interesting here is that these flowering plants, like mountain ash, grow very, very quickly, up to a metre per year for the first 70 years. Then they slow down, but their whole lifestyle is over within 500 years. So it means that they're much, much younger when they die than giant redwoods, which might live to be 1,500 to 2,000 years old. So these giant conifers are slower growing, eventually taller, but much longer lived than our mountain ash. Now, most Australians have no idea this forest is even there. It's 1.5 hours from the MCG. So everybody in Melbourne knows who plays full forward for Carlton or Essendon or centre half back for Collingwood. They've got no idea that this forest is 1.5 hours from the MCG.
So when you were in there, the first thing you were struck by were the size of the trees. What else?
So the other thing that's incredible is how wet these environments are. And the trees themselves actually capture some of the moisture from the clouds. So you have this incredible sheen over the trunks of many of these trees and what's called fog drip, as moisture is condensing on the leaves and then dropping to the forest floor. And the place is very dense, lots of tree ferns, huge moss mats all over the fallen logs. But the other thing that's wonderful about these forests is that because of the size of the trees and the architecture of this environment, it creates an almost cathedral-like soundscape of eastern whipbirds, golden whistlers, olive whistlers, all these wonderful calls that resonate beautifully through this amazing forest.
David, you mentioned how wet this forest is, which has consequences for all kinds of animals as well as plants. Tell me about the shower you took after your very first day setting traps for leadbeater possums.
So the very first day that I started working, I had to put up traps in trees. So I had a huge industrial garbage tin full of traps and trap brackets, drill bits under one arm, and then a ladder, an extension ladder under the other arm. And it was a pretty full-on afternoon setting up a site with all the traps. And it had been pretty wet, and I was wearing my bright yellow rain gear, and I went back after having set up the site and stripped off and jumped in the shower and discovered I had a black necklace. I had about 20 leeches that had found their way underneath my wet weather gear, and it was like a scene out of a horror movie. I was just hemorrhaging everywhere.
Is that just unavoidable? A leech is unavoidable in that part of the world?
Well, one of the things I learned to do was to wear rubber boots because that seemed to keep my feet cooler, and then tuck things in, and then made sure that I had pretty strong insect repellent.
Can't put rubber boots around your neck. How are you going to protect that part of your body?
Well, that's where you put the insect repellent, around your neck and behind your ears, and then you're fine. And you can reduce the leech load, as it were, from about 20 down to one or two every now and then.
Where do you sleep when you're out in the forest doing field work?
So I used to camp when I was doing my PhD. I had a tent and I would camp in the forest, but it's pretty wet. So these days I normally stay in a caravan park or that kind of thing because I come back from counting birds or what have you, and then I've normally got 1,000 emails or however many I've got to sort out, or there'll be something with a grant or what have you that I've got to do.
What's it like being there when you were back in the day when you were camping as night falls, as dusk comes in? How does that change the sound and the feel of the forest?
Well, one of the ways that we count possums is to sit underneath these giant trees and watch them in silhouette. So you don't turn on your spotlight, you don't turn on your head torch, you sit there and watch the tree in silhouette, and you can see the different species of possums in silhouette as they emerge from the tree, and you can work out, well, that's a greater glider, well, that's a mountain brush-tailed possum, well, that's a leadbeater's possum. And so what's happening as this takes place for about an hour across dusk, and what's happening is that you're seeing the end of the day shift of birds, and usually the last birds that are called are the laughing kookaburra, the eastern yellow robin, superb lyrebird, and then it shifts across to the night shift. And so the possums are emerging, there are owlet nightjars calling, southern blue book owl. If you're lucky, maybe a sooty owl in the distance. And so the night shift comes through. And so you can see that the change. And it's really quite a magnificent thing to sit quietly in the forest and just hear the forest doing its thing. Because it's so rare these days with all the busyness of life, you don't actually have that time just to sit and be in a place and experience it.
And then there's a comparable changeover in the morning, I guess, as dawn arrives.
That's right. So often the possums and gliders will do their thing right at the end of the night. They'll fuel up again before they go back into the nest tree or the den tree that they choose for the day, where they're going to camp in the day. Then you start to hear the bird calls coming in as part of the dawn shift. So you hear things like the scaly thrush. The laughing kookaburra is often one of the first things to call, and then it begins from there. The golden whistlers usually take a little bit longer to come in. Grey shrike thrush, all these other wonderful birds. And the resonance of the call, because it's often very still that time of the morning, and you hear the calls reverberating around these enormous trees. Yeah, it's pretty special.
Are early mornings in the forest also good thinking times for you as a scientist?
Absolutely. It's nearly always when I'm doing bird plots or bird surveys. It's not a quiet time because there's a lot of birds calling, but it's a time when you're in the forest and it really stimulates new ideas and thinking about, gosh, you know, I hadn't noticed that before, or I wonder why it's happening in that particular way. One of the things that happens is that if you spend long enough in an environment, you start to think about ideas. I'm infamous in our family for having my little red notebooks and my little yellow notebooks, writing down ideas about things, questions that we need to ask and how we can test them and what data we need to collect to be able to answer that question. A good example is when we were measuring the diameters of these giant trees, and we noticed that almost all of the big trees have these giant charcoal church door-like features. They're burn scars on the base of these trees. And up until we'd started to notice that, the general thinking was that these mountain ash trees were always killed by fire. But clearly, with all these fire scars, that wasn't the case. And that really set a whole new pathway of thinking about how disturbance can be quite different, and then how different animals will respond to forests that have been disturbed in particular ways.
One of the other animals that you started looking at, following on from your focus on leadbeater possums, were southern greater gliders, which also are objectively very cute. This is my scientific category. Both of these creatures fit in the very cute category. Tell me about these animals. What makes them special?
Oh, gosh. The greater glider is just a stunning creature. It's the world's largest gliding animal. It weighs up to 1.3 kilos. And it can glide up to 100 metres through the forest. And it eats only eucalypt leaves.
They do look like koalas to my untrained eyes. They've got sort of ears and faces that really do seem similar to koalas.
Yes, in many ways, some people think of them, because they only eat eucalypt leaves, as a small gliding koala. You can imagine that.
And watching them glide, I mean, the way you were describing this forest, there's a lot of trees, there's a lot to navigate. How do they not bang into things?
It is remarkable to see how mobile they are as they weave between giant trees. And their final landing, if we can call it that, is actually a crash landing, where the animals cling onto a tree and they're silent. They don't call very much, sometimes an occasional little twitter, but you can hear them as they thwap onto a tree and they finish to glide, and then they go up the tree and then glide on further into the forest.
Do those tails help direct them when they're gliding?
Absolutely. So previously we described a leadbeater's tail looking a little like a baseball bat. Well, the gliding animal's tail is in reverse. It's like it's thick at the base and then gets thinner and thinner, and it acts like a little rudder.
They almost look like stingrays, the silhouette of them to look at them. They've got that kind of shape when they're gliding.
That's right. That's right. And if you see them glide overhead, which is quite That's something really special. You can actually see the gliding membranes ripple as these beasties are flying over. So the sugar glider, or Krefft's glider, is in a different family of possums and gliders to the greater glider. The greater glider is actually quite closely related to the ringtail possum, which is a different group of animals to Leadbeater's possum, sugar gliders and others. But they have different shapes when you see them. And so when I've been describing it to people in the forest, they say, well, you know, one looks like a shovel going overhead, if you can imagine that, and the other one looks like a garden trowel.
Are they as fierce as Leadbeater's possums? How do they react to being handled?
Oh, greater gliders are one of the most docile, laid-back creatures, completely different to a Leadbeater's possum. And we've done a lot of work on greater gliders, and when we catch greater gliders, they don't bite. What they do is they pee on you.
What's that experience like?
So because they only eat eucalypt leaves, it smells like concentrated eucalypt oil. and it's very strong smell, and it keeps on keeping on. And so when I worked with greater gliders in the past and been peed on by many of these, the pee used to stay in my watch band. And when I then came back to work in Canberra and I would ride my bicycle into work, that seemed to sort of provoke the smell again, and I could smell the essence of glider.
Little memento from the forest for you.
That's right.
You said these animals don't make much sound. How does that compare with the yellow-bellied glider?
Oh, the yellow-bellied glider is something else. That has a call that's reminiscent of a cross between a squealing pig and a frothing cappuccino machine, if you can imagine that. I used to have a yellow-bellied glider call as my ringtone, and it used to drive my kids nuts. And the greatest thing for them was that I lost my phone in Zambia, and now I can't get that call back. And I think everyone's relieved, except me, because I used to love to hear that call.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanowski. Find more Conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
So, David, were you the kind of kid who was always obsessed with animals, with being outside, being in nature?
I love to be outside, but I was actually ball obsessed as a teenager. I used to kick a lot of soccer balls and thought that was going to be my career until my late teens.
Well, what happened with that? How far did you go with soccer, with football?
I played at a pretty high level in Australia, and then did a fellowship kind of arrangement in the Netherlands. And in those days, the Netherlands was like the world's greatest teams. They were in the World Cup final in 1974 and in 1978. And I went to a city called Eindhoven, which has a very famous team called PSV. And I discovered, I think within 15 minutes, that I was too short and my hands were too small and that physically I was never going to make it as a goalkeeper in an elite team.
Oh, no. So is that where animals or nature stepped in?
Well, prior to that, my father started to get interested in ornithology and bird watching. And so he would take me out on bird trips on Sundays. We used to go out on trips with the local ornithologist group, the Canberra Ornithologist Group, who had the most remarkable people. And when they say they go bird watching, most of the time they're actually listening to calls, not actually seeing birds. And I was just, it was remarkable to watch these people who, it was almost like they would hear a bird fart from 400 metres and they knew what it was. And sometimes they could tell you whether it was a male or a female. Or it was just incredible to listen to these people with their encyclopedic knowledge of bird calls.
Not all of your early experiences with wildlife were as successful as that. Tell me about fishing with your granddad.
So my grandparents on my father's side retired to the northern part of Harvey Bay, a place called Point Vernon. And my grandfather was an absolute passionate fisherman, and he would go out and catch hundreds and hundreds of whiting. He was a very good fisherman. And we would go there often, many, many, many times. And I was hopeless. I am the world's...
Which bit were you hopeless at?
I was hopeless at the fishing bit.
What, all of it, from go to woe?
All of it. I couldn't bait the hook properly. It seems like I was the only person on the planet born without opposable thumbs. And Grandpa would catch hundreds of fish and I would catch none. And so, yeah, we used to sit out on Harvey Bay just baking. But the thing that I found remarkable was that in all those years in the 1960s and 1970s, not once, ever did we ever see a whale, ever.
And now it's a worldwide spot to go and see whales for whale watching.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think about that regularly because what it shows to me is that when we do good conservation and we work out what's really the problem, we can make a difference and things do recover. And the humpback whale population is now estimated to be back around about 40,000 individuals, which is just wonderful.
When your granddad was catching those fish, David, and you were not sitting next to him, were you also interested though in the kind of life that was being pulled up from the ocean?
It was amazing to see all the different things that he was catching. I used to look at flounder and whiting and all these other amazing beasties and yeah, just think about how beautiful they were and how appalling it was going to be when he carved them up not long afterwards.
Was there always a part of your brain then, do you think, that was wondering how things were working in the natural world or looking for understanding relationships and meaning?
I think there was. And I think it stemmed from these epic car drives that my parents took us on, that we used to drive from Melbourne to Harvey Bay in an old British Rover. Gosh, that car just had everything that seemed to go wrong with it. It'd fix up one thing and then be another thing and then another thing would go wrong. And this was in the days there were no Walkmans, there were no CD players.
No air conditioning,
no radio, no DVD players on the back seats or anything like that. And so all you could do was to look out the window and I used to look at landscapes. I remember it distinctly, whether we were driving to Adelaide or driving to Harvey Bay or to other places. And I think that really got me wondering about how places got pieced together.
What happened one January, David, when you were driving back on one of those trips home to Melbourne from Harvey Bay?
So when you're in an old banger of a car like this, these trips just seem to go on forever and ever and ever. And in 1968, we were coming back from a pretty ordinary trip to Harvey Bay. It's wet, you know, going to that part of the world in essentially what's a wet season. My little sister, who was 18 months, was completely covered in mosquito bites and it had been an incredibly long drive. And about 30 kilometres out of Melbourne, we were hit by a drunk driver and we were in a horrendous car accident. My sister was incredibly badly injured.
Do you remember that moment of impact?
I do. I was sitting behind my father and the door on the rear driver's side swung open and then swung back through the frame and cut through my leg. So I broke my patella and had many hundreds of stitches in my knee. And recently I learnt that my right knee is 1.5 centimetres shorter than my left. But my injuries were bad, but not nearly as bad as my little sister, who had a fractured skull and a broken neck. She was only 18 months. My mother had both of her arms broken and she was a concert pianist. And so that essentially ended that part of her career. And then my father, who had the steering wheel basically come up through his chest, broke every single one of his ribs.
Oh.
So it was a horrendous, I can't call it an accident because the driver coming the other way was heavily intoxicated. So it's really it's a crash and it was a conscious decision on someone else's behalf to drive when it's like that. So,
what sort of recovery followed for you and your family? I mean, thank goodness you all lived, but with such terrible injuries, what were the next days, weeks, months like?
I spent a prolonged period of time in hospital, although nothing like as long as my my little sister. And you know, a lot of those injuries, I'm sure, have stayed with my sister for the rest of her life. I think it really highlights the consequences of road trauma, really. One of the things that affected me is that my right leg is not nearly as strong as my left, which, again, that has implications for your career as a footballer. Maybe that's a good thing. And you go on to other things. But, yeah, one of the things that happened with my father was heavily traumatized by this. His aging car was a complete write-off, and he went out and bought the safest car that he could find.
What was that?
Believe it or not, my father bought ex-Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser's Mercedes-Benz.
What?
I don't know how he ended up with that car, but it was a white Mercedes-Benz 220 SE. I still remember it. We even named that car. We called it Murgatroyd. And it was just the most incredibly beautiful car. It was born the same year as I was, 1960. And it was just a magnificent car. It was so well put together. It was such a contrast with the car that my father had before that. And I remember when we went to Queensland to visit extended family, my mother wept when we got to Brisbane. She couldn't believe how straightforward the drive was compared to what we'd had to witness prior to that.
Did that car stay in your family for a long time?
My father owned that car for years and years and years later. I learned to drive in Murgatroyd.
In Malcolm Fraser's old car.
Malcolm Fraser's old car. It had red leather seats, and in the summer they just baked. And so the car was always covered in towels and blankets because you couldn't sit on the seats because it got so hot.
As you mentioned, David, that terrible accident ended your mother's career as a pianist. Where did she first learn the piano?
Oh, gosh, my mother had a remarkable background. She came from a tiny little mining town called Mount Morgan, west of Rockhampton. And she clearly had an extraordinary gift for music. At a very young age, apparently less than four, she was playing the piano. And then not long after that, she was playing the organ in the local church, sitting on seats. But because she was so tiny, my mother ended up being less than 5 foot tall, 4 foot 11 and a half. She had someone playing the pedals for her because her feet couldn't reach the pedals.
So how far did she take that passion? Did she go and study further?
She did. She went to the Queensland the conservatory here in Brisbane. Eventually, she really became notable for her accompaniment and her abilities in that space. And so when we lived in Canberra, there were people, when they came through Canberra to play in chamber music and other classical music, they would seek Mum out and she would work with them and play together.
Did she make you learn the piano too then?
Oh, she did. She made me learn the piano. My hands were never right because, you know, I needed to have tennis balls underneath my hands while I was playing. And I just couldn't wait to be able to say, I don't want to play anymore, which was one of the greatest errors in my life.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I wish I had continued to play. And my brother does. My brother's inherited my late mother's grand piano, which he just loves to play. And it's really quite something. You know, when I used to come home from school, come in the door, sometimes my mother would be playing, but I wasn't able to tell whether it was her playing or whether she had a record. In those days, they were, you know, vinyl, whether there was a record playing. And she had perfect pitch. So if you played a bum note when you were practicing, she would hear it from anywhere in the house and tell you about it.
Did your dad share her passion for music?
Yes, my dad loved singing and he loved classical music. So they both had really good ear. And I think that really helped my dad with his ornithology, because when you go out bird watching, you hear more than you see, and you don't see things often until you hear it first. And so being able to commit all those different calls to memory is a really important part of those skills for birds.
What did he do for work, David?
Oh, gosh, my dad actually started life as a rocket scientist, believe it or not.
A rocket scientist?
Yes, he trained as a chemical engineer at the University of Queensland. So he also came from very remote parts of Queensland. His father was a policeman And he ended up in Brisbane and then at University of Queensland, and he studied chemical engineering. And he ended up at Woomera in South Australia at various stages, mixing chemicals for rocket fuels.
Did he talk about that with you much?
He didn't talk about it very much. I think he was, I don't think he was embarrassed about it, but my dad was a very peaceful person. And I think he was very conflicted about the fact that he was working in munitions and rocket fuels and other kinds of things that I know later in life it did disturb him, and the conflict between peoples and between nations was something that was a real issue for him.
So what change did he make in his professional life then?
My father retrained in economics. My parents moved to Canberra, and my father was in the public service. At that stage, Prime Minister Robert Menzies was moving significant parts of the public service from Melbourne to Canberra. So my father and mother moved to Canberra, and that helped him as in his progression in the public service.
What sort of presence was he at home, David? Was he a close person to you growing up?
No, my father was incredibly vague.
Vague?
He was incredibly vague, and it was very difficult to connect with him unless you were doing something together. So he loved cricket. He was passionate about cricket. So I spent a lot of time bowling to him in the nets. And then he became passionate about his hobbies, and one of those was ornithology. So one of the reasons that I got into bird watching was to be able to try to connect a little bit more with my father. And I think one of the issues with Dad was that he was always thinking about other things relative to where he was at that particular time. So that was quite frustrating unless you got connected with him through his hobbies.
Well, one of those people that you could say something and you could just see it go in one ear and out the other.
Precisely.
So when you started going bird watching with him, where did he like to take you? What was the special place that he would go looking at birds and listening to birds?
We went to lots of different places so that he could add to his tick list of the different things that he'd heard. But one of his favourite places to go was on the outskirts of Canberra at that time in the 1970s. It's a place called Mulligan's Flat. And Mulligan's Flat is an area of temperate woodland. Now, temperate woodlands are one of the most altered ecosystems in Australia. So if you came to Australia at the time of British invasion, 1788, and you'd landed in Melbourne rather than Sydney, you could have walked from Melbourne to Brisbane through almost continuous temperate woodland.
What's it look like, a temperate woodland?
So it's between sort of 15 and 25 metres tall. It's often open, scattered trees with large gaps between the trees, a grassy and shrubby understory. It's not tall, wet forest, which is dense and dark. This is sort of more open environment. And most of that temperate woodland, up to 99% of it, has been cleared for farming, for agriculture, for grazing. But there was an area of temperate woodland on the outskirts of Canberra, and my father became really interested in it because it's got a whole suite of birds that you don't see elsewhere. Hooded robins, brown tree creepers, diamond firetails, a whole range of beautiful birds. And so Dad was insistent that we went out to Mulligan's Flat so that we could add these to our lists and learn their calls and wander in those wonderful places.
Would it just be the two of you, David, or would he go with a group of people?
Sometimes it would be just the two of us, and that was a good way to be able to connect with Dad. And sometimes it would be with the great folks of the Canberra Ornithologist Group, COG, that's still in existence and still does great things. And Dad became really passionate about these temperate woodlands. He realised that they were very special. And this particular area of about 1,500 hectares is the largest remaining area of that woodland type anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world?
Anywhere in the world.
It's, as you say, right on the outskirts of Canberra. How on earth was it not built on or developed back in the day?
Well, Canberra was at that stage relatively small, but there were big plans for major expansion. And this area to the north of Canberra, it's called Gungahlin now, and it's full of people, you know, there's 100,000 people there or thereabouts. Dad saw that if we weren't careful, all of that woodland was going to be cleared and we're going to lose one of the most important habitats of its type anywhere in the world. And so Dad got together with a whole group of colleagues and started lobbying government to have this area conserved, set aside as Mulligan's Flat Garuyaru Reserve.
Your father passed away in 2022 and he suffered from dementia at the end of his life. What did that mean for your relationship with one another and the kind of things that you'd obviously love doing together, like bird watching and being out in nature? How did that change as he got older?
Towards the end of my father's life, he did start to suffer from dementia, and he would have these almost hallucination-like spells. And I would go and sit with him in his aged care facility or ring him, and he'd say, "David, I've just been at Jervis Bay." That's where we have another one of our long-term sites. And when he first started to say that, I'd say, "No, Dad, you're in your aged care facility. You're in the south of Canberra. Don't be silly." And my wife said, "David, don't do that. Just let him enjoy his memories." And so the next time I would chat to him, he'd say, "David, I've been at Jervis Bay and I've been on site 12F and I've seen these birds and that bird and this bird and this bird." And I would shake my head, because actually what he was telling me had seen was pretty close to actually what is on site 12F. So he's obviously got these incredible memories in his mind of the remarkable birds that he would have seen, and kept those memories and tell me about them, even though he's 400 kilometres away.
What a beautiful kindness of his mind to himself, in a way, to take him back to this place that was obviously such a joyful, special place for him and for the two of you.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that my dad did was help organise volunteers, very, very good bird watchers from the Canberra Ornithologist Group, to come out with us on these long-term field trips and help count birds. And Dad just loved that. And all these other wonderful bird watchers would be there, and they'd tell stories about wedge-tailed eagles or diamond firetails, and other things would be happening in the world, like, you know, X or Y president had been whatever, and they'd talk about that for 20 seconds. And then they'd talk about brown tree creepers or wedge-tailed eagles or whatever again. So that was clearly something that was very special in Dad's mind.
How many bird books did he leave behind him, Dad? Oh,
when we were sorting out all of his possessions at the end, Dad left me a library of about 500 bird books, and I'm still wondering what I'm going to do with most of these. Many of them are outdated, but others aren't. And some of them are quite useful for other people, and I've donated those books to them.
How have you and your brother commemorated your dad at this place, Mulligan's Flat, that he loved so much and did so much to protect?
So after Dad died, we got together with the Mulligan's Flat Trust and people from the Canberra Ornithologist Group, and we bought a wooden seat. And on that bench, there's a plaque dedicated to my dad, and it's actually a pretty special place to go and sit, look out into Mulligan's Flat. There's a visitor centre there and a fire pit, and to think about not only my dad but all the other dedicated people that really did make a difference to protecting a very special place that people from all over Canberra and all over Australia can go and visit and see one of the things that he was passionate about, but also wanting to make a contribution to the future of this country.
Do you think much, David, about the relative scale of a human life with the kind of landscapes, environments that you spend your time researching and protecting?
I think about it all the time, because I think about the sort of the day-to-day relationships that you have with people. But then I look at some of these forest environments, you know, being in a forest, being in a woodland, being in a heathland at that point in time. But then I also think about some of these environments over the long term. My career is in forests has been for 40 years, and my hope is that maybe I can do another 20 years of work. Gosh, if David Attenborough can still be working at 94... hopefully I can still be working in 30 years' time as well. But I also look at some of these forest environments, and I'm aware that, you know, we've had forests in Australia for 180 million years. And that means that forests have been doing their own thing for 179,930,000 years without people, you know, messing them up and disturbing them in some ways. So that notion of time, and it is remarkable about how much things might have changed or not changed over that time.
And maybe, I don't know if it feels comforting to you, this thought that your dad's gone, Mulligan's Flat lives on, you'll be gone one day, may you live a long and happy David Attenborough-like life, but those forests will continue.
That's the hope. And the concept here is to make sure that we can leave a good legacy for future generations. You know, the legacy of having stopped whaling across the eastern seaboard means that those remarkable animals have made an extraordinary recovery from a couple of thousand animals back to 40,000. And the idea that we can conserve the tallest flowering plants on the planet, not just for people in Melbourne to see or people in Victoria, but for all people in Australia to go and see, you know, visit the football, visit the zoo, but go and visit the forest.
And to preserve them for their own sake too, not just for the value of humans to trek off and look at them. You know, you've shared quite a few really positive stories of change and protection, you know, the Mulligan's Flat, the whales returning. Do you feel that you're optimistic about the state of our environment? Are you optimistic by nature or by determination?
I'm optimistic by nature, but also optimistic by determination, because I can see through good conservation, we can create not the mantra of jobs versus the environment, about jobs and the environment, you know, creating better jobs, longer lasting jobs for people through nature-based conservation, through better treatment of our natural assets. For example, these forests that we work in Victoria are the most carbon-dense forests anywhere on the planet. Their preservation then becomes a critical part of tackling climate change. But there's a workforce that's needed to manage that resource. And so there are opportunities, job opportunities for young people in rural and regional Australia and elsewhere to be able to contribute in important and meaningful ways, opportunities for First Nations people working on country and other folks to really make a difference in this space. And to me, that's exciting.
When will you next be able to get back into those forests?
I will be there on the 13th of April, the 14th of April and the 15th of April, taking field tours but also doing some measurements of big trees, and I can't wait to get back.
Well, David, the next best thing to being able to go into those forests myself is hearing you describe them so eloquently. Thank you for being my guest on Conversations.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.